All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast PT and Strength and Conditioning Podcast. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
How's it going, everyone? Good to be back. Sorry we missed last week. I had a little scheduling snafu, so Adam was nice enough to hold off on the podcast for 1 week, but now we're back, and today we're going to be talking about strength training for hikers. We got some good feedback about strength training for runners during our last episode. So as hiking season is upon us, hopefully you guys can take one or two gems from this to avoid injury.
Yeah, and I think, we'll go over a couple. All of this stuff is going to have some crossover. We'll probably end up talking a decent amount, or I shouldn't say a ton, but we'll have some crossover from the running and all that kind of stuff, because there's some very similar patterns, very similar symptoms and, in quotes, injuries, injuries just in terms of, where people are feeling sore and that kind of stuff. So
now you talked about the carryover or kind of the crossover of what we were talking about last time. Really, if we think about hiking, for the most part, and this is just a general statement, it's still a sagittal plane motion. Mm-hmm. It's front to back. We're always moving forward. Now, the biggest thing being between running and hiking, or there's a couple of them, we have a normal walking pattern when we're hiking, unless you have one of those people that actually run when they're hiking.
Right.
But we have double foot stance. Or two-foot stance, which we have to take into account. But then we also have the incline and the decline of the actual mountain, and that puts a lot of abnormal stress on normal tissue. And this is where I believe most people just automatically assume, listen, I've trained for the last 51 weeks, mm-hmm. and now I'm going to go hiking. Oh, look, I went hiking and my knees are killing me. The act of hiking is nothing that we can replicate.
Right.
It's just one of those things, unless you do it 12 months out of the year, you're going to decondition to it, and then you have to start all over again. Our hope with this episode and our suggestions for exercises is to minimize some of that early soreness that people will get early on in the season, so it can minimize hip pain, knee pain, ankle pain, whatever it may be, and even some balance exercises as well. There's an inherent risk with hiking, so we're not going to be able to take away all of it. But we're trying to set you up for long-term success so that we can minimize a lot of this the common soreness that we'll typically see with hikers.
Yeah, and I think, there's a lot of, there's a lot of this stuff that you would kind of imagine. It seems so similar, right? Just instead of, running in a straight line, you're walking uphill. I mean, obviously there's more, it's not like all hiking is just literally walking up versus walking straight, but there are a lot of nuances that you don't necessarily realize. We talk about like lateral movement. We talk about that with everything. Is everybody thinks so forward and back, when realistically there's a ton of work, equal-wise that you should be doing side to side. And it's even more so accentuated in hiking, because there is so much. The potential for instability when you're hiking is much higher than if you're running.
Correct. Even if we look at it from an orthopedic standpoint, think about hiking uphill. You need to have increased dorsiflexion so that you're clearing your foot from the ground. That also means you need a deeper knee bend. That means also your knee is going to come out over your toe to produce force. You're also in increased hip flexion. So that's already a different demand compared to the likes of running. Right. Because you're using more of a natural recoil, you're getting that elastic property from the muscle to actually spring you off. Hiking, you don't necessarily get that. You have to create the muscle contraction every single time. So can we train that? I like how you pointed out the side-to-side muscles, because if we're forcing ourselves up the hill, mm-hmm. which is essentially what hiking is, we become very dominant in those bigger, stronger muscles like we've talked about. So hip flexors are going to be too strong, quads are going to be too strong. The glutes, assuming you're able to accentuate hip extension, are going to become very strong. That's a positive, not a negative. But then what happens to our stabilizers? And then take into account, oh, I have a 25-pound pack that's on me. I'm not using hiking poles, which I'm not saying we should, but that's two more points of contact to offset stress. So again, all of that repetitive stress plus the ground reaction force that's ricocheting through our body, we have to take that into account. We can offset that with training, maybe not 100%, but maybe we can do it just enough to to then allow ourselves to avoid some type of a pain syndrome.
Yeah, and I think it's important, too, to remember, because we keep, you know, we've said that a couple times, too, here, and we, you know, have touched on it in the running podcast and stuff. When you're doing any sort of activity, the first time out of the year is you're always going to be more sore than you will be after that. So try not to be like, especially if you've prepared, try not to be super over concerned about it. Your first time running, you're going to be way more sore. Unless your training is literally running the distance you're going to run on a treadmill for the entire, and I'd argue that's not even the same, but regardless, it's like when you go out and ski for the first time or snowboard or whatever, that first time you're always feel beat up, no matter how much you prepared for it.
Yep.
You know, a baseball player, no matter how much they prepare for it, their arm is still going to be sore the first time they go out and throw 100 pitches.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't replicate the demands of any given sport completely with training. Yeah. You can set yourself up so that as soon as your body remembers and gets used to it, you're good to go. You're going to recover quicker and all that kind of stuff, but try not to be too concerned if you go out for your first hike of the year and your knees are sore. Doesn't mean you can't ever hike again.
Sure.
It means you haven't hiked in a year and your body's got to get used to that movement again.
So I'm glad you said that. Now, what if you had someone who came in today and said, hey, I'm going hiking this weekend. How can I minimize my soreness? What's one easy thing that you can tell them to do?
Loosen up.
I mean,
roll, stretch, whatever, you know, prepare yourself for it.
Exactly.
Get some good sleep, hydrate yourself, you know, bring water with you, you know, that kind of stuff, simple stuff, assuming that they've been, you know.
Things to offset the stress.
Right.
You know? Now, if they're not willing to do that, which most of the people that deal with us usually are, and they're usually doing it to some capacity, then I'll usually have to recommend decreasing the volume.
Right.
You know, then it's, all right, you were planning on a 4,000 footer, how about 2,000 feet, 2,500? You know, you want to make sure you're minimizing the foot contacts, because I guarantee you're going to hurt yourself if you go do a 4,000 footer.
Right.
It's just people don't remember, you know, they're spending all this precious time and energy going up the mountain.
Right.
By the time they come back down, you're already fatigued. So it's just, you have to build up tolerance to that. Yeah.
I hate the down.
Oh,
it's terrible. I could do a 6,000 foot mountain up if I could get helicoptered back down. I hate that.
Just let me roll.
I know, right?
Yeah, but it's,
where's the slide?
Exactly. It just amazes me how people are surprised by that. I'm like, so you're telling me that it just took you 2.5 hours to hike to the top, and then you're surprised your knees were killing you on the way down.
Right.
I'm like, were you able to sleep at the top of the mountain for 8 hours and get plenty of nutrients and rest? No, we just went right back down. So now you're adding more work on top of fatigued tissue.
Right.
It's bound to happen. But that's where training comes in.
Right.
Because again, we're going to make someone stronger to go up the mountain and then hopefully have some more in reserves and make the body better withstand the eccentric force of essentially you're catching yourself against gravity.
Exactly.
Gravity's trying to shove you down the mountain and you're just learning how to throw the brakes on a little bit more efficiently. And if we can do that, that alone will help take away knee pain while hiking. Because when your quad muscles are too fatigued, they can't throw on the brakes, they can't stabilize, and then it feels like that bone on bone sensation that hurts for the next 5 days.
Yep.
It's that gnawing, throbbing sensation. You feel it every time, you know, your heart beats.
Yeah.
You know, anyone who's hiked has experienced this. So that's why I'm describing it this way. So, all right. So let's go ahead and get into it. What, from a performance standpoint, what are a couple exercises that you recommend that people should do in preparation for hiking? So let's say it's 4 or 5 months out. And they say, I want to get ready for hike season. I want to start doing this. What are you going to recommend?
So if I were to, I mean, you know, obviously your, you know, squats, deadlifts, all that sort of stuff. But if I were to boil it down to a couple that I think are super important that you really should try and get in there in some fashion, you know, as much as you can in quotes, obviously not over the top. But I tend to think single leg deadlifts and either lunges, step up, something like that.
So why are you putting an emphasis on those exercises versus what you previously said before, the regular squat and the regular deadlift?
Because those also add in a function of stability into it as well. I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, it would be, you know, your you know, split your unilateral movement. So something like a split squat along with something lateral, like a lateral lunge or a lateral squat, and then, you know, something like a goblet squat, something where you're hitting all three of those. But if you had to really boil it down to, you know, biggest bang for your buck, something that's unilateral that forces you to create some amount of stability plus work on those eccentric and concentric movers, I think does a lot.
Can you just take a moment, and for those people that are they're listening, just what do you mean by eccentric and concentric?
So concentric is basically the portion of a muscle movement when the muscle shortens versus eccentric, which is when a muscle elongates. So for example, if you're doing a goblet squat, so you're holding a weight right at the sternum and you're going down into a squat and coming back up, the eccentric portion of the movement is when you're going down. Those muscles are lengthening. And then when you're coming back up, those muscles are contracting or shortening to pull you back up, essentially. And it's, if you think about it and why it's so important, it's exactly the way it works when you're hiking, right? Concentric is when you're going up the mountain. Eccentric is when you're coming down the mountain. Everybody thinks about the concentric portion of a movement. It, you know, the up, you explode out of it. It's the bicep curl. It's, you know, it's the part that most people think of when they talk about muscle contraction, but it's only half of the process. And it tends to be the process that is, I don't know if more easily controlled is a way to put it, but pretty much the concentric portion is easier to control.
It's easier to control.
No, I was just going to say, and that's why you have to be thinking about the eccentric portion when you're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, we want to always add the education piece in. Do you remember the length tension curve from exercise science?
Vaguely. Sure. The further you get to each end range, the less the force is produced.
Correct. So muscles typically have the strongest amount of force with 50% overlap of the muscle fibers. So if it's too stretched or too shortened, we can't produce the same force. When we're going up the mountain, you know, we have pretty good overlap of those bigger, stronger muscles, so they're going to be stronger going up. The only problem is those bigger, stronger muscles are now placed on stretch when going down. Now, you mentioned people put a bigger emphasis on the concentric. Would you say that's true for just your average gym goer? When they train, do you find that they really just focus on the concentric?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not necessarily like a, you know, they think it's more important than, it's just, you know, you, when your goal is like on a deadlift, your goal is to pick the weight up. You know, if you've ever done a deadlift, maybe deadlift isn't great because not everybody's deadlifted, but a squat, your goal is to get up, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's talking about, you know, it's not about how can I get down to the, if you're an older person, let's say, you know, an older person who's just worried about getting down and up off a couch. All you ever hear about is the getting up from the couch, right? Yep. Because gravity brings you down. So why is it important to think about the, you know, not is it important like you're actively choosing to ignore it, mm-hmm. but people focus on the up. Or the out, the part of the movement that actually, in quotes, builds the strength.
Yeah.
You know, without, because eccentric and stuff, that can get a little nitty gritty if you're focusing, like, wait a minute, so I have to worry about the down and the up. I don't quite fully understand the up as it is, and now you're telling me I have to, so I can kind of understand it, but that's what we're here for, to kind of help you understand why some of those are important.
Absolutely. Yeah, and one of the things that I love about the exercises that you picked is it's very rare, unless we're resting during hiking, we're very rarely in double limb stance,
mm-hmm.
you know, at least for prolonged periods of time.
Right.
So having that unilateral or asymmetrical stance pattern, like running, replicates the act of hiking, you know, whereas if someone said, every mile that I hike, I then do 50 squats, well, then we got to change it up and start practicing squats. But it's unlikely that people are going to do that. So now we talk a lot about strength training, but ideally when we talk about strength training, we're also using this globally and talking more about performance training as far as flexibility is concerned. Now I know the jury's out about flexibility training. It doesn't say that it improves performance. Some people are suggesting we shouldn't even have to do it. I personally am a fan of flexibility training. I know you guys do it here as well. So what are some common areas that you find are a little too tight and people would benefit from stretching?
I think lateral hips for sure. I mean, that tends to be something we run into with just about anything. Quads, hip flexors. I mean, if your quads are tight and your hip flexors are tight and your lateral glutes or your basically the side of your hips are tight, then for example, let's say that you're doing a more aggressive hike. You know, something where you have to actually like step up onto next ledges or that kind of thing. Going to be real hard to get your foot up high enough and then also create the force to propel you up if your quads are super tight, which means that you can't get as big of a bend in the knee. Your hips are super tight, which means you can't get the knee up as high anyways.
Yep.
Or your knee has to move. If your hips are real tight, it'll mean that your knee has to move laterally in order to allow you to get that range or, you know, whatever.
Sure.
So it just, it helps you be able to move more freely. And I think those are two that are tight on most people regardless. Never mind people that are hiking, running, that kind of stuff.
I would agree. I think those are stretches that just general health people should be doing, especially when people sit too long.
Yeah.
You know, so I always recommend lateral hip stretching. And for me, it's as simple as just doing a seated figure four stretch, you know, or a pigeon pose for those people that are more into yoga type poses. But we just get locked down there. And that's why a lot of people get hip bursitis or they end up having pain when they're sleeping on their sides. So I'm in agreement with you. The only other one that I would add is probably just the calves.
Yes.
You know, just from that push off and with plantar flexion, because we're typically going to stay heel down, roll through the midfoot, and then we have to create a larger force to go through propulsion. So the body's going to store that energy and you're constantly just flexing, extending the whole time at the ankle. And that just builds up a lot of tone in the calf muscle. So we'll talk about self-massage and soft tissue stuff later. So just from a flexibility standpoint, if we lose flexibility at the calf, that's going to pull on the Achilles and then potentially have an effect on the plantar fascia, which we'll talk about some of the syndromes that we can develop down there as well.
How do you feel? Sorry to interject here. No. How do you feel about, and we won't get too far because this could go off, but how do you feel about like height, like shoes in terms of hiking? Like do you, because to me, in terms of thinking about how much of that plantar flexion and dorsiflexion is required, even more so for hiking than it is for running because you're at an angle, I would, you know, I know that the idea behind a high boot, I don't know why I can't think of the word, but like, you know, like a high top, there we go, that's the word. High top hiking boot is to keep your ankle stable, but it also cuts down on your ability to actually move at the ankle. Is that something you
I'm not worry too concerned
about?
Okay.
Okay.
No. You know, it's just like basketball shoes. Now you're seeing more low tops versus high tops because they found that if you lock the ankle down, then unfortunately you're going to have more knee injuries.
Yep.
So that doesn't concern me. What I want is just a solid support on the bottom. The footbed wants to be solid. So if you're a pronator, you want to make sure you have something that prevents you from pronating so that the knee doesn't cave in. Mm-hmm. If you're a supinator or have really high arches, then the insole should be more cushioned so that you can actually absorb the shock. But as far as the height of the ankle, really doesn't concern me. Maybe if someone has known ankle instability, chronic ankle instability, or a lot of uneven terrain in the ground, you know, there's the potential for the ground to actually move.
Right.
You know, then there's a possibility I want to lock it down more. But just your average hiker, your average terrain, that really doesn't faze me. Now we've talked about strength training for the lower extremity. We've talked about the quads, so we know that's super important. You mentioned deadlifting. I'm assuming with deadlifting you were focusing on the what we would call the posterior chain, the hamstring and the glutes. Can you just explain why the hamstring and the glutes are also important? Because a lot of people just want to train the quads.
Right.
You know, we see them.
Right.
They're big and powerful. Why would a hiker, or why would anyone for that matter, want to strengthen the glutes and the hamstrings?
Well, so for a couple different reasons. For when I think of the glutes, it tends to be more about, I tend to think when the hamstrings, it's more about the deceleration piece. With the glutes, it's still about the up. I mean, yes, it does help decelerate on the way down. But if you can't get full hip extension, then you're basically you're basically using your quads the entire way up. So you have to have the glutes, because yes, the quads are what straighten your legs, but the glutes are what straighten you at the hips. So if you're constantly bent forward and you're unable to actually get that final push off to get yourself up tall, you're losing strength, you're losing, in quotes, power. You know, not everybody that's, you know, walking up a mountain is focused on, like, power per se. Not in the way that you normally think of power, but being able to get up and get that last little push off is also going to save your quads over the length of that.
Sure.
And now when it comes to the deceleration, I think they're even more important. Because what people don't realize is that the hamstring, people tend to only think of the hamstring as A, something that's tight, or B, something that, you know, if you've ever gone to a gym, you've seen the hamstring curl machine. It's something that brings your heel to your butt, essentially. But one of the biggest things that the hamstring does, and it's why it's so huge in ACL recovery, when somebody has an ACL injury, tear, whatever, is because the hamstring is actually a knee decelerator. So it attaches at the hip, but it also attaches at the lower leg, or at your, you know, kind of, it crosses the knee joint. So as you're coming down, basically what the hamstring is doing is your whole femur wants to keep going forward. The hamstring pulls the lower leg back, and so it helps decelerate on the way down. So if you don't have strong enough hamstrings, then you're basically relying entirely on your quads to slow you down on the way down.
Yep. And then that's going to increase shear in the ACL.
Yep. Yep.
So,
I mean,
so that's one thing that we have to be mindful of as well.
Yeah, so that's why it's so important in order to, you know, have strong hamstrings, strong glutes on top of the strong quads, because you have to be able to decelerate or essentially catch yourself going down, and that's what those muscles functionally do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before lateral lunges. Mm-hmm. You know, typically we want to work in the frontal plane or side to side so that we can work on the stabilizers. You know, and specifically, I believe you were leading down the path of like the glute medius and things along those lines. We talked about with runners, you know, even just doing functional sidestepping with a band around their ankles. Yep. would be great. So we've hit the bigger muscle groups in the legs. We hit the stabilizers at the hips. What emphasis do you put on core training for these individuals?
The core training is, I mean, I don't treat it much different than I do anyone else. The core training is full body. We was it the last podcast we talked a little bit what we personally defined as the core?
Yeah.
I think it was, yeah. So because everything is, you know, working together. Like you hear core training and people think, oh, crunches and flutters and sit-ups. But realistically, especially when it's something like hiking, you know, if your body isn't working as one solid piece, that's where you can run into trouble. If your left foot, if you slip on a rock and your body isn't able to stabilize essentially the rest of your body, mm-hmm, because of something happening on your left leg, you're, you know, more liable to injure something, fall, trip, you know, not able to catch yourself.
Yep.
So things like farmer's walks, you know, anything that is a full body core, in quotes. If you're, you know, something like planks are helpful. Now, again, we've talked about planks before, not something you necessarily need to do for 6 minutes or you need to do until you feel the burn, but it can be a lower volume, but it's still a full body move, a full body exercise that teaches the body to basically transfer tension from your ankles to your shoulders.
Yeah. You know, another great exercise is even just doing a trap bar deadlift.
Yep. Yep. You know, yep.
So.
Yep.
Something simple as that, just picking up a kettlebell off the ground. Any exercise done correctly should be a core exercise.
Absolutely.
You know, because you're setting up stabilization. So again, we've talked about the plank does not have any correlation with performance. If someone has low back pain, if someone has hip pain or something along those lines, even shoulder pain for that matter, I'll give the plank, I'll give bird dogs, I'll give dead bugs, whatever we choose to call it, as more of a facilitation exercise. Mm. You know, this is where we should feel it. You know, pull in here, brace here, you know. Oh, now integrate this in with shoulder blade squeezes, squeeze your glutes. So really I'm teaching sequencing, mm-hmm, you know. But then the goal is, can the body do it on its own without even having to think about it? You know, we've talked about before, if I try to reach out, touch the microphone, my core is already tightening before my arm leaves my body. It's anticipatory, and we need to retrain that. So for hikers who say, I'm going to take my next step, the core is already tightened, you know, and what we do know with individuals, especially those with weak hips, so hikers or runners that have weak hips, we also know that their core doesn't function normally. So we want to make sure that those with patellofemoral pain syndrome, you know, just anterior knee pain around the kneecap, have strong hip muscles and they have a strong core. They all work together. So I'm not going to place greater emphasis on one area compared to the next as far as the hips versus the core, because I want to train them together. You know, my area of emphasis right now for hiking is that eccentric control, you know, but I can do that in a multitude of ways. So my question is to you, again, if someone came to you and said, what's one exercise I can do? I need to focus on the eccentric portion. What are you going to give them?
I mean, my number one pick, assuming that they can, you know, complete the movement well and under control, is a single leg deadlift. Mm-hmm. Again, that hip stabilization and it... Okay. Let me walk that back a little bit.
No, just keep going.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to follow up with another question.
No. So, like, and you have to control the down portion of the single leg deadlift. Basically, the best way to train your deceleration is just to control the down in whatever lift you're doing. If you're doing a goblet squat, it means that you're controlling the down, and then you're coming, you know, does it mean you have to do like a 2-3 second eccentric, like 2 or 3 seconds down? That's great to help you teach yourself how to control it. But at the end of the day, it's just, are you coming down under control, or are you just dropping down and coming back up out of it? And you can apply that to any exercise. Step ups. Are you stepping up and then are you controlling it down as much as you can, or are you just letting yourself collapse back to the floor? You know, you can work it into any exercise. It's just about, are you coming down under control no matter what the exercise is?
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question. You know, with the deadlift, we're working on the posterior chain, you know, more so the hamstrings more than anything. And then my next question was going to be, what if we had to pick an exercise for the quads?
Yeah.
You know, and I think the step-ups are great. If someone doesn't have a box, I usually just recommend lunges. I think that's a great exercise. Even just stationary split squats.
Yep.
You know, just focus on the down portion coming up at a normal speed.
You can do things like a front foot elevated split squat too. Maybe you don't have a box, but you could put your foot up on, you know, like a 2x4 or something. Just something that elevates the front foot slightly.
Yeah,
like,
it works to a depth, and I think that's definitely beneficial for anyone
who wants
to try that. You know, even if we're not hiking, even if we're not running, we should really focus on the eccentric, because we know eccentrically we're actually stronger.
Yeah.
You know, we because of the pull of the muscles in a lengthened position, if we were to compare how much weight we can lower versus how much we can lift, we're stronger in that lowering position or lengthening position. However, we just never train it. So then what we end up seeing is that we can't control forces and we don't have any tolerance or endurance built up to it. So another reason, obvious reason why people don't train that way is it hurts.
Yeah.
You know, that's really where you're going to get the micro trauma in the muscle, which creates that delayed onset muscle soreness, which may not happen for 24 hours and then may last for 3 to 4 days following, you know, which people need to understand. Very, very normal. It's a stress adaptation response. You know, you overload the tissue. It needed to create that adaptation. So the next time that you go do it, it's not going to hurt as much. And then you can keep lifting more and more. So you're increasing the muscle's capacity. So any other training principles as far as strength or flexibility is concerned that you want to touch upon?
No, I just think it's important to have that the hip mobility and the core control. And that's, you know, it's funny because like hiking is really just like outdoor walking uphill. When I think of hiking, I'm thinking of like, you know, stepping up on ledges and having to step over rocks and branches and all that sort of stuff. I'm somebody that like, if you just tell me that we're going on a long walk uphill, I'm like, nope, I'm good. Like, yeah, it's beautiful, but I want to be like grabbing rungs, grabbing trees, stepping up, climbing up ledge, you know, ledges in quotes. I mean, I'm not free climbing, but so, like, I think about, okay, I have to step up on something that's, you know, knee height. Am I able to get my foot up there, create strength, without collapsing to one side or the other? And am I able to redo that over and over and over and over again? So basically what we've talked about, I think, is really, it's just the stuff that has to be the base first.
And we've talked about there needs to be a foundation that has to be built before you can progress beyond that.
Right.
You know, and again, a lot of that has to do with mobility, stability, strength. You know, and again, some people say, you know, you need to have good strength. But really, if you think about it, in order to have good strength, you need to have mobility and stability. Yeah. So again, those are non-negotiables.
Right.
You know, power you build on after the fact. You know, reactive stabilization is after the fact. So we need that solid foundation. Now, if we start to get into some of the common injuries that we think about with hiking, you know, what, let's say a person goes hiking and they come in and say, oh, this body part is really killing me after I just went hiking. It was more so on the way down. Which body part do you find is the most common?
So the knee.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked, is that, I don't know if you were looking for a different one just because we talked about that. But yeah.
9 out of 10 times, that's the first body part that people will say, on the way down, my knee was killing me. Yeah. On the way up, I was fine. Well, that's because you weren't fatigued and right. You're shortening your muscles, so you feel fine. Now, typically when people come in and they say this to me, usually I say, give it a couple days. Don't freak out. Like, you didn't do anything wrong. You know, I'll hear it all. Meniscus, MCL, cardiac disease, I don't know, whatever they want to call it. You know, this happened when I was hiking downhill. I'm like, if you just waited 72 hours, if it came down, you have nothing to worry about. Like, don't freak out. This is not a problem. Now, if someone has some type of a pop, click, their knee gives out, so there's some instability, like drastically, not just a little wobble, but drastically. You know, those are the times to worry about it. But there's so much strain and the knee was put under so much tension, no shit, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
This is very normal. And then I say to them, if you go hike the next weekend, do the same exact trail, same exact weight in your pack, you've already created that stress adaptation response. So will you be sore? Yes. Are you going to be as sore? No. Again, it may get to a 5 instead of a 7. It may only last a day now compared to 3. And then if you go do it again, now it just should just feel like muscle soreness on each side. You know, maybe it's tight when you sit in the car on the ride home. You get out, you move around, you stretch, you're fine the next day. Resistance training is no different. Running is no different. Bench pressing is no different. No matter what you want to do, whatever activity it is, shoveling for the first time is no different. Mowing your lawn for the first time is no different. It's just that first time you need your body to catch up. Now, if someone comes in with knee pain following hiking, what are some of the recommendations that you make for them? What do you say to do over the next couple days?
Foam roll the hell out of it. Heat, water, maybe some stretching too. If you're not, you know, if it doesn't feel like you're forcing it.
Yeah.
You know, if those muscles are really beat up and you can't even really get any looseness with rolling and that kind of stuff, usually stretching is not the way to go. Just because your body will be fighting it. It's right. Not like you're going to rip a quad muscle, but it's not going to help you. So you might as well just spend the extra time rolling or, you know, even like a heating pad, anything that increases the blood flow to that area that allows, you know, people don't tend to think whenever you exercise, that energy production creates metabolites and things that are, for lack of a better word, stuck in that muscle bed until it moves out of there, which can cause the soreness. And it's not everything, but the quicker that you can get fresh blood flow, get the stuff, the crap that's left over from muscle contraction out of there,
yep,
and the good stuff in there to help heal everything, the more you do that, the quicker it's going to recover.
Correct. Now, how common is it that you'll see back pain from hiking?
Not nearly as common as the knee pain, but it happens.
Sure.
I
typically find that if someone's already had back pain when they went into the hike, it sure as hell doesn't help.
Right.
Or they had on a heavy pack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually I'm not, unless someone falls or usually it's not going to be too drastic, but if someone has on a heavy pack and they've had a history of low back pain, you know, they'll definitely get some tightness, you know, and if we think about wearing the pack and going uphill, we have to pitch forward.
Right.
your back just doesn't have the resilience for that unless it's something, you know, a deadlift may have helped with that.
Yep.
You know, so something along those lines. So what do you do for those individuals when they come in?
It's hip, it's rolling, glutes. Because the other thing, I mean, we talked a little bit about eccentrics, right? So if you're somebody that doesn't do a lot of glute strengthening stuff, meaning deadlifts and bridges, whatever, stuff that increases the strength of that posterior chain, then, like I was talking about before, you're not able to get up as straight when you're walking or when you're stepping up or whatever it may be. So you spend more time forward, which is what we were just talking about. So the glutes are basically extended the whole time. Eccentric increases soreness and then increases tightness, right? So if your glutes are extended the whole time because you're leaning forward, then they're going to be tight on top of, you know, whatever else might be going on. Yep. So getting the glutes nice and loosened up, lateral and, you know, even the large, even your glute max, your big glutes, is going to be helpful. Probably some quad stretching and because that stuff, again, if you're super tight in the front, it pulls you forward and adds even a little bit more stress to the back. So a lot of this stuff will overlap, but quads and lateral hips are my two biggest ones.
Well, and I think what you pointed out, you know, working on all of that glute tissue, I think that's also going to save people from developing any tightness in that lateral thigh region or what they would call, oh, my IT band is acting up.
Right.
You know, that's very common. You know, oh, I my IT band is acting up. I went to see so-and-so. They told me to stretch the IT band. Unless you have, you know, a Chevy or a Ford truck hooked up to your IT band and you ask someone to gun it, you're not going to stretch the IT band, you know, and even if you do, you're going to stretch it 1% and it goes back to its original size within 24 hours. So we have to target muscles that are pulling on this connective tissue, which is everything that you talked about, you know, the lateral hip musculature, the glute max. So we have to reduce the tension in those muscles to then reduce that IT band tension. And then I typically just find the lateral hamstring, you know, the quad, again, is going to be super tight in these individuals as well. Maybe even down, and it could be into their ankle as well. But I think that's a good place to start, you know, at least to minimize low back, hip, or IT band pain. Now, plantar fasciitis, it's what's interesting about this is I typically don't see plantar fasciitis as much from hiking, unless someone has had a known Achilles tendonitis somewhere along the line. And as we've talked about in the past, whether and we've done a couple episodes on this, typically there's going to be increased tightness in the actual gastroxoleus complex with limited ankle range of motion. So you have those two things, and that's going to put you at an increased risk of Achilles tendonitis and plantar fasciitis, or fasciopathy, whatever you choose to call it, fasciosis. They have so many different names for it now. We correct both of them the same way. You know, again, an Achilles is in a tendon, just has different types of collagen fiber makeups compared to the plantar fascia, which really is going to help to maintain your arch and increase basically the lever arm as you go through propulsion, pushing off on the big toe, which think about as we go uphill, we need that larger production of force from the plantar fascia so that it can exert the force through the tendon so that you can turn on the gastroc and the soleus. So let's say someone comes into you today, hey, I was hiking, I have Achilles and plantar fasciitis pain. What are a couple things I can do today for this?
Calves.
Calves?
Usually if with the calves, I've learned it's really hard foam roller or a lacrosse ball.
Yeah, you gotta mash those suckers.
Yeah. You gotta find the spot where it feels super uncomfortable and you just gotta beat the hell out of it.
Yep. Yep. And typically, you know, if someone does well with that, I'll usually just say just roll the bottom of your feet too.
Yep.
You know, we have four layers of muscles underneath all of the ligaments and tendons and plantar fascia that are also going to accumulate stress. And especially if you're not wearing the appropriate footwear, we're just mashing we're pancaking everything on the bottom of the foot, which can lead to an increase in thickness in the tendons and the ligaments. We can also see the muscles aren't going to work the way that they should. So we're literally collapsing everything into the ground, and the ground has to shove everything back into our foot. So really what we need to do is get blood flow to the area, and we need to increase surface area. You know, it's like I tell people with a roller when they're rolling out dough. You know, you're smoothing out the lumps and bumps, and you're increasing space. And that's all we're doing. It doesn't matter what body part we're talking about. When we're able to do that, smoothing out the lump and bumps, and we're increasing space, that's going to allow all of the structures to glide properly. And again, as we just described, you know, for any of the listeners, you know, just have an idea of what's on the bottom of your foot. Just go to Google Images and type in muscles on the bottom of the foot. And it's going to show you the different layers, the different tendons that are in there, shows you all the different bones that are in there. There's really not a lot of wiggle room, and really the foot's a cornerstone for what we need to be able to do. It touches the ground, it sends sensory information to the brain, it sets us up biomechanically for our lower extremities. So, you know, I don't think we put enough emphasis on foot health. So rolling the bottom of the foot, rolling the calf, and then I usually like to follow that up with some type of stretching. So whether it's a calf stretch, I think people do well with that. But then we also have to load it. Mm-hmm. So once we loosen it up to the point that we are happy with it, we then got to increase its tensile load. So then looking at doing like a jump squat or something along those lines, that just increases the strength of all those structures that we talked about. So now we've talked about self-massage a little bit. What emphasis would you really place on foam rolling to increase someone's movement health with hiking? You know, so if someone started today and they said, I know I'm going to strength train, we know that's a big part of it. How much time and energy should I be putting into foam rolling or a self-massage?
I mean, I'd say at least 50% of the time that you're putting into the lifting. I've never really thought about it in terms of percentages, but like if you're going to work out for a half an hour, you probably want to spend 10 to 15 minutes doing your self-massage stuff. And that's not necessarily a forever thing. As I say the numbers out loud, it sounds like a decent amount of time. And again, that's maybe not all in one sitting, but you want to make sure that you're, you know, setting yourself up to not only strengthen, but you still got to maintain movement.
Correct.
Too.
Correct. I was thinking 30%. You know, it was kind of just a number in the beginning. You know, 30% self-massage. Yeah. And that's assuming they don't have any injuries.
Right, all things considered
equal, 30% foam rolling, 70%. You know, with that foam rolling, you can throw in some stretching too. You know, we don't want to make this too complicated. As someone gets closer to their actual hike, you know, maybe they drop it down to 20%. Maybe they go up to 40%. It doesn't matter to me. It's how do they feel? What do you feel like you need as you get closer to the event? As you increase your strength training, there are going to be certain areas that yell at you more. So feel free to use it as much or as little as you want, as long as it's not interfering with performance.
Right.
You know, and ideally, it's not going to interfere with it. The only way I could see it interfering is if you're not doing it enough, staying on top of it. But I don't know too many people, or actually, I don't know anyone who said, I have foam rolled too much where it doesn't allow me to do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
You know, I know people transiently who said, oh, I feel like I irritated this a little bit because I sat on the ball for too long, whatever it may be. But usually it goes away and the next day they're fine. So it can happen, just rare.
Right.
You know, usually foam rolling that in that point from a threatening standpoint, it's very benign. No, you're not going to hurt yourself doing it. Or you're not going to harm yourself.
Right.
You know, you're not going to break anything. You know, it hurts. It sucks. We all know that. But you're not going to harm anything. So, you know, really the biggest difference, you know, when someone comes into me, I try to identify all these areas that they can then treat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all the areas that you already talked about, someone comes into me, they usually have pain. You know, that may not necessarily be the case every time someone comes into you. But, you know, I think you addressed it perfectly, you know, when I threw those scenarios out to you, you know. And I'm sure some of the listeners were probably like, well, why the hell is he asking him about that? He's the PT. But it's just always nice to see your perspective of it because it's very similar.
Right.
Know? Really not a lot changes. You know, the biggest difference being I get to stab people with needles and I get to jam my elbow into them and I get to manipulate their spines when I need to or ankles, whatever it may be. But, you know, as long as people take away, you know, the importance of strength training. You know, you got to train the muscles that you need. You have to train the muscles that you don't think you need. You know, it's got to be head to toe. You can't just focus on your legs. It's got to be full body training. You don't have to emphasize core over the rest of it. You know, so planks are fun. They're nice. But is it going to be the best for performance when, as far as hiking is concerned? Foam rolling should be a part of if not an everyday routine, every other or every third day to kind of keep you going. Flexibility training does offer a benefit. So even though the research questions whether we should perform it or not, there's still a benefit to it as far as I'm concerned. So
I think it's important too to listen to your, like, listen to your body too. You were talking about you know, some people, maybe they're foam rolling more closer to their event, maybe they're foam rolling less. There's so many factors. You gotta, if you wake up in the morning and you know it's gonna be 85 degrees that day, you already feel pretty loose, like maybe you're only doing 5 or 10 minutes of foam rolling. If you wake up and you get out of bed and you're like, you know, like cracking every time you move and everything feels tight, you know it's gonna be a cold, maybe you spend a little bit more time on foam. You kind of have to.
And that's usually, I find that there's just potential overtraining or you know, you're not getting enough sleep or underhydrating. So there's a bunch of other things that can be addressed at that point as well. I mean, no one should move that way.
Right.
I don't
care
how old you are. But it happens.
Right.
You
of course.
Know, and again, we got to look at the variables. You know, there's a stacking of risk factors that we can look at, and we can say, oh, we know why this person moves this way. And then you just got to start chipping away at those risk factors one by one. And generally, you can get them moving better, you know. And typically what we find is as we get into these warmer seasons now, it's much easier for people to warm up and get going into their activities compared to the middle of winter when, you know, it takes us a little bit longer to get going. So, but this happens whether you're 25 or 50 or 75. It just depends where do we need to start. So, all right, what do you think? I think we touched upon everything that we wanted to today.
Yeah, I think so. So you guys know the drill. If you have any questions, all our info is in the details, as well as a link to Ross's Wellevate page. If you have any questions or want any recommendations on supplements, Ross doesn't ask Ross anything, everything. Nope, anything. I was right the first time.
First time.
Thursday nights at 7:30. You said you're doing it every 2 weeks now.
Yeah, so it'll be tonight. Yeah, so I'll take next week off.
Yep. So until next week, guys, we will talk to you later.
Have a good one.